We have a, I haven't started yet. one of our sort of mantras at IA is bits in, bits out. And so I liked it. Like Mark did, like bits in, and then I'm going to do bits out. So we have a couple of web games.
Okay, now,
Thank you so much.
So we do a lot of, so I wanted to talk about trying to get web archives into the hands of researchers, especially for computational data research. What happens with web archives when you crawl the web is they go into these things called work files. Web archives resource container, I think, is an ISO standard, and it's like a piece of just maddening junk. It's a concatenated GZIP file of concatenated GZIP files. So it's totally arbitrary in what goes in there. The crawler opens the file, starts pumping in data, and you can set a size, and it will close off the file at that point, and then it packages it up into a work file. They can have tens of thousands of HTML pages in there, or it can have one big YouTube video file in there. So very arbitrary. So that makes it very hard for researchers to work with because it's a somewhat obtuse format. It's also, of course, most of our crawls, we have about 13, 14 petabytes of web data. So that's a lot to work with, and even things like Archivit accounts are often multi-terabyte collections, and people are very challenged as far as data mining on them. So what we're trying to do is take the stuff, and of course the last one is that there's often IP or content restrictions to giving people stuff that is being copyrighted. So a lot of partners that we work with for in libraries archives teams don't want to hand out full raw content, but they do want to support data-driven research. So what we're trying to do is we make these what we call derivative data sets. And we're doing things like pulling out specific metadata elements that are not full-page text, putting them in raw JSON files instead of in WARC files, and then often building APIs and other access methods on top of those. So there we have WARC files, which are sort of key resources from each record in the WARC. Things like page title, anchor text, meta tags, obviously all the capture provenance, HTTP information, and stuff like that. We have graph files that are this linked to this with a timestamp for every single capture across a big collection. And then we are doing things like named entity extraction, topic modeling, and other things like that. And so we take all this stuff that is valuable within the work, but it's not the entire work, put it in JSON, and then make APIs on top of it and give that to people. So we do sometimes big transfers of data to people on disk, but we're really excited about things that are facilitating programmatic access to archive content while getting around the size and complexity conditions. So, how am I doing on time?
You got 19 seconds.
Okay, well, I can post a bunch of scripts. I was going to demo, like, you can just do little shell scripts and get crazy, awesome information. But instead, I thought what I would show, because it's relevant, and it's coming out for our 20th anniversary, is that Vinay Dole, who is one of our senior data engineers, has been doing comparative capture snapshots of front pages, and one that we thought would be awesome would be news. And it goes on for a while. It gets better when it gets well. So it's USA Today, New York Times, and Wattpad. And so we'll put this media file up in the next week or two, and you can sort of play it and pause it, and they're all on the same day. So it's really interesting to both track the sort of visual change, and so you know, we're about 20 years old, so you can look at all the graphic design changes, but also see how different stories appear in, you know, quote unquote, the three most popular U.S. newspapers. So, yay, research stuff.
And as you point out, after the break, there may be the broken track discussions. Jefferson, you're going to be in here talking in more depth about this, so thank you for the sort of preview there, the conclusion. Terry. Very good. One of our students.
People ask, what do I do in research? I usually reply a little bit of journalism studies, psychology, sociology, and just a tiny dash of neuroscience to really make things interesting. So what I wanted to do for this conference is to take some of the psychology and sociology concepts that I'm using in research and tie those together with digital archiving effort as a whole. So basically, everything that we experience on a daily basis has a potential to become something called episodic memory. If you remember who you sat next to on the flight over here and maybe the topic of conversation you might have had with that person, that is a form of episodic memory, or that is an example of episodic memory. However, we're not omnipresent and omniscient beings, so we don't know everything that goes on at every point in time, and that's why we depend on the media to make us aware of events that we don't experience directly. This creates a type of memory called mediated memory. In other words, the experience and or the knowledge of events given to us through mediated forms. If you go back into the foundational literature for communication studies, you find that one of the primary functions of the media is to transmit social and cultural heritage. I chose a photo there of Texas State High School football championship game because, believe me, from personal experience, nothing is more social and cultural heritage in this world than Texas High School football. So in performing this function, the media content over time serves to help establish something called collective memory. That's a social construction by which we, as a group or as a society, remember events, commemorate those events. Memorials would be an example. Without media archives, that becomes far more difficult. And that's because, as time goes on, we lose, through mortality, all living witnesses to events that take place in time and space. What we have left are the media archives. And I will wrap up by saying thank you for attending this conference. That's a T-shirt that only a guy who started his professional career at 14 and in his 50s decided to become a journalism scholar. It neatly summarizes the plight, I think. Anyway, there's all my contact information. I welcome any questions or comments or discussions, and thank you very much.
Next up, we have Katie Boss and Eva Revere from NYU. Can I hang on to that? Oh, sure. Eva's on.
that. Hi, everybody. You guys probably remember me from yesterday, but I'll do a quick introduction again. I'm Katie Boss. I'm at the New York University Libraries, Librarian for Journalism and Research and Communication. And my two co-authors on this project are Eva Revere and Meredith Broussard, who you guys heard from earlier in the news at the panel. Both at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute. And we're talking about news applications and challenges and archiving, preserving, and also very important for libraries, making these things discoverable for our users. So I think I'm preaching to the choir a little bit here, but who is creating these things and why would we care to save them? They're data, journalism projects, and news app creation is exploding. And these projects represent some of the most creative, innovative projects as a subject selector in libraries. I can sometimes say, these are things we need to save. If we're going to save anything, we need to save these, right? So what are some of the issues facing this? We also heard about this a little bit on the panel. But one of the fundamental issues is that these are not static digital objects. They are dynamic digital objects. So there is currently no way to save these things. The Internet Archive can't do it, nobody's figured out how to do it. And yet we have years of these projects that are not being saved anymore, except on random hard drives and servers. So we have to figure out a solution. One of the big problems related to this is something that's known as dependency health. So these things are built on complex software stack, and every aspect of these things has dependencies and libraries that they need to run. So if any one of these parts in the engine that runs these news applications is missing, it's not going to work. So a lot of the talks that we've heard from today are everyone scrambling to migrate things to a more current form. Migrating things from microform to PDF, right? All of these, the New York Times having to migrate things from different forms, get it all in one form so that you can do the batch process things later. We're all doing migration. The digital archiving community has come to one consensus on dynamic digital objects like video games or like news applications, things that are interactive, rely on a database, and that is that migration is not really a solution because there are too many things to migrate. We start thinking about it, all of these different software tools and libraries and frameworks, Django, Rails, etc. Ben was mentioning this, they're on and on, right? Are we going to migrate all of those? The digital archiving community has said that's crazy and it's not going to work. Like it's already not working with analog objects. So emulation has been reached as the consensus. Instead of trying to migrate these things, we need to emulate them. How are we going to emulate things? This is the research that we're working on right now. How can we create a virtual machine that we could use to preserve this and then emulate the entire environment on a computer or whatever it's going to be 100 years from now? Long-term preservation. We're not just looking at 10 years, we're looking at 100 years. So the first step to this, answering this question, and I'm trying to use these two so Eva can talk, is that we need to figure out how are these news apps being built. In order to figure out a tool that we can properly use to save them, we need to really be able to describe what are they. So we started a survey tool, and Eva's going to talk about that for 1 minute.
Hi, I've been working on gathering the data that we asked for in the survey. We have data on about 50 apps regarding the type of software frameworks they built with, who's building them, where they're stored, what we were able to gather some initial findings, such as like most popular frameworks, which were already mentioned, like Django and Rails, and also being able to see leadership processes for which they are stored and served, primarily S3 like flat file storage, and we've also been able to look a lot at the legal framework and copyright. There's a lot of open source, but also like, a lot of proprietary.
Okay.
And we wanted to do a shout out to Ben Welsh because your Janko bakery is apparently being used by everyone to build these things. That's what we're discovering. So this is a group effort, saving these things. We need everybody kind of involved and on board. Thank you so much, Dave.
Thanks, Katie and Eva. Next, we have Cynthia Joyce, University of Mississippi. And you sent me one, right?
Which is actually a really good way in, and you know, go to them and say, hey, Dan Baum at the New Yorker, your stuff is gone. What about me bringing this back up? Anniversaries provide a really great opportunity. Newsrooms kind of hate them because they have to cover them and they don't know how to come back at them. It's a really great, I feel like, Please Forward is the name of the book, and I feel like it's a really good case study. Thanks to the archive at folks and Jefferson Daily team, it now exists online. I don't think that if I had just gone to news organizations and said, hey, I moved a bunch of stuff from online over here to another place online, I don't think anybody would have cared. But because we sort of pulled it out and excavated it and created something, then this turned into a bunch of other things, radio and podcasts. Involved.
Anyway,
thank you for
your more than 3 minutes. Yeah. Next, we have Jennifer Younger. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ed. It's great to be here. I'm here on behalf of our many stakeholders, our partners, our members, advisors, and of course, founders. What's fascinating, our work, our project has been a collaboration right from the beginning. Our partners and stakeholders, they know their they know what they want, they know what their interests are, they bring expertise, and in some cases, they bring funding. In a nutshell, this is what we're going to do. We started, and we're going to end with preserving the digital files. We're live on the web, a status report from today. Perhaps the most challenging, although I didn't realize that at the time, aspect of this has been working with the publishers, the copyright owners, who are the right, non-revocable, non-exclusive, to produce, make available, and digitally archive the content of their papers. Tomorrow, we have big plans. We have a target of 350,000 pages. More importantly, we're setting up a community platform because we know there are Catholic newspapers out there who are digitizing on their own and want to add their content to the archive. Our job is to make that possible and easy for them. Digital preservation of Catholic newspapers today is nowhere, but everyone wants it. That's the good news. So our approach has been to choose an established program, in this case, Meta Archive Cooperative, because it's a good fit for us. They have experience, they have expertise by and for working with memory organizations. Our biggest challenge is developing a long-term sustainability plan. Who pays for what, and what's the potential revenue, from whom, for what, to whom? I'm not a digital preservationist. I have learned and educated by colleagues, including Sam Meister and Catherine Skinner at Educopia. So I have learned how digital preservation works. I have learned more about how it works. My takeaways on all of this are that trusted digital repositories are not accidental happenings. They require skilled operation, standards, systematic audits by yourself, by external agencies such as the center. Fortunately for us, our partners and our founders say yes. They know why digital preservation is important. They get it. And they put more of this, the reasons, on our website under our Catholic Newspapers program. Thank you. It's great to be here. I invite you, this is our invitation to you, if you're looking for a proof of concept and you're looking for somebody to work with, we're here. Thank you.
We have one more. Okay. Colin?
Okay. Well, thank you so much for having me here today. So this is my vision. This is the GDEL project. The idea of the GDEL project is how do we take the world's information and try to catalog what's happening around the world, moment by moment, and how people are reacting to that, the events, the emotions, the reactions, both the textual and the visual narratives that surround that. How do we preserve that as well? So like any good project, it begins with data. And it has many different data sets that feed into it. So news materials, print, broadcast, and web, over 100 languages supported, covering every country of the world. 65 of those are live machine translated in real time as they arrive. In collaboration with the Internet Archive, as Mark helpfully put in there, to preserve as much of that online material, and we're constantly ramping up the volume of material they're preserving for us. And the goal of that is to really say, you know, especially with online material, again, so much of this material is ephemeral, especially when you move outside of the U.S., as you know, obviously in Turkey, most recently. Television, so again, we have television partnerships around the world, but again, also within the United States. Collaboration given with the Internet Archive process about 100 stations here. Academic literature, so this is collaboration, JSTOR, Retail Core, Science Here Again, Internet Archive. Boston Trinity works covering 7 years. So we provide the context to why things happen around the world. Books, you know, the backwards in history, human rights, and film imagery, which I'll come to in a second. So again, obviously, as we all know, most of the world does not, you know, English is not the primary language. So this is a map of where GDEL has pulled information from the first 6 months of last year, color-coded by the primary language. Where is English? So obviously, a lot of the work that has been done historically in preserving online media has focused on English. And as you can see from the gray spots there, if that's all you're preserving, you're missing most of the world here. Now, of course, broadcast and print are very crucial because many of the areas of the world, print and broadcast are the only source, especially broadcast are your only sources in those areas. But again, this really shows you, you know, how important it is to reach beyond, and especially to do things like translation or process things in languages other than English. In terms of preserving online news, about 140,000 articles that we monitor each day disappear within about 2 months. And this is a very important thing for us because this tends not to be, it's not evenly distributed across the world. For example, in Nigeria, under Goodluck, articles that would criticize the government's response to Boko Haram tend to have very, very short shelf life indeed. Obviously, Turkey, many countries around the world, but also even here within the United States. A news outlet goes bankrupt, a small, you know, small local outlet goes up. Also, again, news outlets, unfortunately, are more and more pulling material. Also, as we've seen, many major publishers now treat content as very fluid. They have no fear of editing material in real time. And also, I want to point out in the fall here, so a lot of efforts have been done to date have really focused on things like manual archiving. Say, hey, a major disaster just took place. Let's start preserving now. You missed that. So in the fall, for example, we grabbed about 667,000 articles over the year following that earthquake, really capturing especially the local perspective of things. We can do a lot with that material, so we can do everything from mapping human rights violations to looking at refugee flows, man pads, and all kinds of other things. Also using the Google Cloud Vision API, we're cataloging a large fraction of all that imagery worldwide each day, about 150 million images to date from almost every country in the world. We're extracting out locations, activities, objects, facial emotions, OCR native languages, and also things like violence and so on. So in both cases, we're not just as a textual narrative, but really for the first time to be able to peer into that visual narrative. And finally, I want to leave you with this map. Once you have all this data, what can we do with the world's needs? And how do we think about it in new ways? This is a very simple map to look at global happiness through the eyes of the media. 200 million articles in 65 languages, 750 billion emotional assessments, including things like anxiety, fear of the future, optimism, and so on. 1.5 billion mentions of location, and 150 million images. And being able to come up with a map of what does that show us? At least through the eyes of the world's news media, what are we seeing? And again, being able to make maps like this and say, well, why do we see more red here? What does that tell us whether this is legitimate? Or for society or whether the media in that particular area focuses and portrays things in a particular light. Thank you very much, and you can come to my talk this afternoon to hear more on this.
Thanks, Colin. And yeah, as you said, his session will be one of now four options that we have for the discussion period after the break. And that will be in the Research Commons classroom, which you can basically go through those pods and you will see towards the back there's a classroom, you have to sign that. Next, Catherine Skinner is going to introduce our next speaker.
Oh, I'm here.
Yeah.